Sure. So my name is Brian Gracely. I'm director of product strategy for Red Hat's OpenShift platform. We're kind of the core group within Red Hat that's responsible for Kubernetes, for platform integration, for having to run containers at scale, and then we also work very closely with the other groups that work quite a bit with the CNCF. So the groups working on projects like Istio and, some sort of modern application development. We work with the middleware group and so forth. But OpenShift is ultimately kind of the core container platform for Red Hat, working closely with the Linux platform, with RHEL, in terms of delivering the container runtime.
My Kubernetes knowledge is okay. I actually recently did a roundup of managed hosting options for Kubernetes and, of course, encountered OpenShift. But maybe let's just do a little bit of background on what OpenShift is and, I guess, why Red Hat created it in the first place.
Yeah, so and I apologize for anybody who's listening because history lessons are never super interesting, but let me put it in context. Red Hat, probably 6 or 7 years ago, there was a huge interest in the marketplace in, trying to make developers more productive, trying to make it simpler for developers to just write code and then, push it somewhere that would just run, right? Hide all the infrastructure complexity, security complexities. And so we got started, OpenShift really got started when people were talking about platform as a service or PaaS. And, there was a lot of different PaaS platforms that were out there at the time. There was Heroku, there was Google App Engine, Cloud Foundry Project. we were all moderately successful at helping developers, write some code and then not have to care about it. The problem with the kind of the market, that market segment in general, was there was so many options and we never really got to any sort of standardization. And so you never got the benefit of, what open communities tend to do, which is, there's a few competing type of approaches to solving a problem. Eventually one of them tends to be where the community gravitates to, and then you get acceleration. So we, as lots of different PaaS platforms, we never saw that acceleration. We never saw standardization of how to package your applications. We never saw standardization of kind of the orchestration or how to run the applications. And so what happened was you had, in around 2014 or so, 2013, 2014, you had the Docker project come along. And what Docker essentially did was made it really easy to get containers running. They made it simple to use. They standardized kind of a way to use C groups and namespaces in Linux. So that sort of solved half the problem. It was like, okay, great. Now we have a standard way to package an application in a container. And that was always more complicated than it should have been in the past. And then and then Google came along and said, hey, we're going to release this project called Kubernetes. It's based on a bunch of DNA that we have internal to Google, and it's going to help manage containers at scale. And that became the other half of the equation, which was, okay, how do you build the engine, standard way for building the engine to run lots of containers at scale? And so what OpenShift decided at that point was, Red Hat basically, we always found that the best formula for us and for our customers is go to where there is some standardization in open source, contribute heavily to those projects and try and make them successful. And so we made a really big decision back in 2014, and we said we're gonna stop doing homegrown container packaging and orchestration, and we're going to get behind the Docker project and the Kubernetes project. And those became the core elements of what's in OpenShift. So OpenShift is, fundamentally kind of a containers as a service or platform as a service platform. It can operate sort of in either mode, but under the covers, it's using Kubernetes as the engine that says you have an application, you'd like to run it. This is how we're going to run it: highly available, highly secure, highly redundant, and resilient, and so forth.
Just out of interest, I mean, firstly, how long has OpenShift actually existed as a
platform? It went to market in 2011. So it was in, you know, it was in the marketplace for probably 3.5 years before, you know, as a purely a PaaS platform. And in 2000, so that was version one, and version two of OpenShift were, you know, kind of the PaaS specific, Red Hat homegrown. You know, it was always entirely open source, but kind of homegrown technology. And then version three of OpenShift, which was the beginning of 2015, was entirely converted over to being Kubernetes based. So we've been doing Kubernetes, you know, since Kubernetes 1.0, before 1.0, and you know, so 3+ years now in the market.
And did you use something else before, or it just wasn't a necessary option at the time?
Well, everybody who had a PaaS at the time, whether it was us or Heroku or anybody, under the covers, they were all using containers, right? That was the way to make it efficient use of computer resources. And we all had sort of a homegrown version of what Kubernetes does, which is, you know, orchestrate deploying the application, making sure it's healthy, you know, restarting it if it fails. So yeah, we had a, you know, think of it as sort of the OpenShift orchestrator, if you will. We never really gave it a name because you didn't see it. It was just, you know, processes under the covers. It was a big leap of faith for us to take, because essentially we were taking the engine out of the airplane while it was flying and replacing it with something else. But it's, you know, turned out to be a really good bet. It's, you know, it's getting in very early, working really closely with Google, and working with the broader Kubernetes community was a really important decision for us.
And as far as I understood from my own research for the article I wrote a couple of weeks ago, you add a fair few things to your implementation of Kubernetes as well.
Well, so this is where history is a little bit important. So, you know, when Kubernetes first got started, it was a really limited functionality. You know, people look at Kubernetes now and they go, well, it, you know, it does more things. There's more stuff included in the project. But when it first got started, it basically was an API and it was a scheduling engine, right? It doesn't provide a lot of the things that we expect from people. So there was no container registry, you know, a place where you could store your containers. It didn't really have a standard way to interconnect networking. It didn't have a standard way to interconnect storage. It didn't really understand the concept of anything but a stateless application. And so what went on was, you know, you had customers who said, this seems like interesting technology, but, you know, this is never going to work in my environment because it doesn't do a lot of these things. You know, what do I do? And so we ended up kind of doing two things. One was, we had done a lot of those things in the PaaS platform, you know, the ability to attach storage, the ability to, you know, do complex networking, routing, and so forth. And so we first and foremost said, okay, we're going to take a lot of the knowledge that we have and put them back into the Kubernetes community. That's always been what we do, right? That's always our model is upstream first, and then things become commercial. And at the time, the Kubernetes community could only handle so much stuff, right? There was only so much upstream development they could handle and integrate and so forth. And so there was some things that we did in OpenShift that, you know, we've been trying for a long time to push into Kubernetes. It was the wrong time, or, you know, the community wasn't capable of dealing with it. So, you know, there's some things that we have done, or we had done, that eventually became part of Kubernetes. So like, for example, we wrote a lot of the storage integration, you know, for integrating different types of storage, block storage and file storage. And so, you know, we did that, and it was, you know, it was in our platform very early because we already had the code. We wrote a lot of the role-based access control, or RBAC. You know, so there's a lot of things that we had done. The other thing that's happened is, you know, there were some technologies that didn't exist when Kubernetes started. For example, there was never a concept in Kubernetes of like, how do I describe an application? You know, so if I want the application to say it's always got, you know, five replicas of it running. And these are the, you know, this is the label that I want because the label is going to tell me which project it's associated with, you know, kind of a descriptive thing. There was kind of some really primitive stuff that existed. And so, you know, having us having worked with a lot of enterprise customers and sort of knowing what they needed, we said, well, you know, we're going to create something. And so we created a concept several years ago called templates. And templates are nothing more than just, again, a descriptive file that makes sense to developers. Well, over time, an open source project came along called Helm, which has now become kind of the de facto standard. And, you know, we look at that and we go, okay, cool. You know, we're not going to throw away the thing we have because there's a bunch of customers that use it. But we are absolutely going to get behind, you know, now supporting Helm as the package manager. And so, you know, we've since added support for, you know, for doing, you know, for people bringing Helm charts, which is the, you know, the new kind of manifest file. So things like that happen. There's been other work that we've done. Like we're one of the only companies that for a long time did multi-tenancy for Kubernetes. And so we, you know, we kind of said, okay, we know what it does. And then customers came back to us and said, well, that's not going to work for us. We're a company that has multiple divisions or, you know, have to have isolation for security reasons. We need multi-tenancy. And so we built that, into OpenShift. And, but a lot of the things that were in OpenShift to make that happen, have subsequently either we've helped do it or other people have helped do it, put it back into upstream Kubernetes. So the way to look at it is what we do for Kubernetes is 100% Kubernetes. Like we don't make any changes whatsoever to the core APIs or anything like that. So if anybody says, hey, is this compatible with Kubernetes? Yes, it's 100% compatible. There's nothing that we change from that perspective. And we'd be crazy to do that given how much people expect Kubernetes to be interoperable. What we have done is, you know, we see that there are some areas that, you know, customers specifically want that are kind of enterprise specific. And we've done some things above and beyond that. So, you know, the multi-tenancy stuff, you know, integrating like, a more advanced service catalog and user interface. But those are all, you know, again, they're above and beyond anything that Kubernetes does. They're more platform level user experience, developer experience types of things.
So one of the reasons we lined this interview up was that, almost 2 weeks ago now, Red Hat announced, well, I guess both parties announced that CoreOS was being acquired by Red Hat. I think they've always been a company and a bunch of projects that have appealed to me. Firstly, I guess because they're one of these companies that were sort of, I guess they had very little history before the kind of modern container space. So it's sort of their container native company, I guess. But also because there's actually quite a lot of CoreOS people here in Berlin who I've met. So it was always, just, projects that I heard mentioned a lot at meetups and things here. And I mean, I know you can't talk too much about what that's going to mean to OpenShift yet. I think probably primarily just because you don't actually know yet, not for any legal reasons or anything. They have a lot of technologies. So, I mean, it's interesting. One of the things that fascinated me the most, just because I've met some of the evangelists behind it, is because they one of their projects is the Rocket or Rooket, however you want to pronounce it, container format, which they've always evangelized is better than Docker for various reasons, but it's not massively well supported in tooling. I mean, without going into any detail, if you don't know at all, but is that something that you feel could do with better support in Kubernetes, or will it sort of maybe vanish somewhat? I don't know.
Yeah. So let's kind of take, I want to break it up into two parts because there's a couple of interesting things that you highlighted there. So, the CoreOS team is a really interesting group for, it's funny you say like they didn't really have any history, and you would think that because they're a bunch of young people, and so you go, oh well, they're only so old, they can only, you know, they must have. But if you, so the two founders, Alex and Brandon. So the two founders basically had started a company before, right? They had sold a company to Rackspace. And the thing that's really interesting about them is they've been operators in a prior life. And so they brought, when they started CoreOS, they basically said, if I was an operator today, starting in the world today, I would be really interested in having an environment that is like always secure. I don't want to spend all my time constantly like patching and maintaining operating systems and environments. Like, why can't there be an environment that would just sort of auto update for me? And since it's auto updating, it's going to always get me as close as possible to being, you know, kind of in that secure state, right? Like, it's going to have the most common patches, the most frequent patches. And oh, by the way, if I was building it from scratch, like I wouldn't include a lot of this other stuff. I would start from the bare minimum. So that was like the foundation of their company was, we want to build highly automated, highly secure environments. And oh, by the way, we're going to do it all in the open source community, right? Which, you know, is kind of a crazy concept to for somebody to take on, because it's a huge, you know, it's a huge idea. You know, we're going to, you know, Alex likes to say things like, we're going to secure the internet, which is an insanely big idea. That you're going to do it in open source, you know, as a little company sounds crazy, because, you know, communities are big and how do you influence big communities is a small, but that's what they did. And, you know, so you look at some of the ideas they've had, and they seemed really radical. They seemed radical back in 2013 and so forth. And you were like, okay, well, you know, you guys are young. Maybe you don't know what you don't know. So let's see where it goes. And they just started executing, and they're really, really, really good engineers. They're world-class engineers. They have been very focused on, you know, how to build distributed systems. So, I mean, you know, they started off with CoreOS Linux, which is now called Container Linux. They built etcd, which has become this, you know, worldwide phenomenon as a distributed key value store. You mentioned Rocket. You know, their thing was, they were a small company. They didn't want to create Rocket. They wanted to work in the Docker community. And they just found that, you know, the direction of the Docker community, where it was going in terms of security and in terms of kind of, you know, could it be maintained and could it be secure? They tried really hard, and they just, you know, they weren't able to make it, you know, to make the changes that they wanted to have change. And so they were kind of forced to create Rocket. And then what happened was the community ultimately said, hold on, guys, we appreciate what you're doing, but creating a big fragment and forcing the industry to sort of pick isn't necessarily the best thing for the community. And so, you know, while Rocket still exists, the mechanism to do the things they want to do has ultimately become the thing that's now called OCI, which is the Open Container Initiative, right? So, you know, the way to look at Rocket is not so much like, as an individual project, is it still, you know, heavily maintained and is it everywhere? The way to look at it is, they were able to accomplish the thing they wanted to do through the OCI, and the really nice byproduct of that is, oh, and it's now a standard, right? And like lots of companies can, you know, contribute to that. Red Hat does, and Google does, and Microsoft does. And so, you know, they accomplished what they wanted to do. It's not necessarily called Rocket anymore, but, you know, because they've been so focused on saying, hey, we're going to do things in the open community, you know, you have to look at that and say, that's a win for them, because as a little company, you don't want to own the project. You want to be maybe driving it. But you know, they don't own etcd anymore. It's a, you know, massively used community project. We use it inside of OpenShift. Google uses it. And so I think that was, you know, if you get back to saying like, you know, why was Red Hat interested in this company, which is kind of ultimately what a lot of people are asking. Yeah.
That would have been my next question. So yeah, yeah, as much as you're allowed to go into.
So sort of knowing a little bit of that background, you look at that and you go, okay, well, what were they interested in? They were interested in open source and communities. They were interested in containers. They eventually became interested in Kubernetes. Well, all three of those things are right in our sweet spot. Like, it's a technology space that is exploding for us. And so the ability to take on talent and people that have a vision in that space is super exciting. And then from a technology perspective, you know, Red Hat looks at what's going on in the world and we say, well, people want their IT to be more frictionless. Like, they don't want to have to spend as much time maintaining stuff. They want to be able to work across multiple cloud environments, and the cloud already is pretty efficient. So, you know, being able to help people be efficient in the cloud, but also efficient like in their own data centers, like, that's super interesting. And so, you know, when we start to combine those things, which is world-class engineering, people that absolutely believe in open source, they've got expertise in some of these core areas for Red Hat, and then, you know, they've got expertise in stuff that we didn't before, which is, you know, automated operations, dynamic updates, immutable systems. They're really well known in communities like Prometheus, which is, you know, the one that you know in Berlin. Like, it's a win. It's kind of a, you know, it's a wonky term, but it's sort of a win-win in a bunch of different parameters. It's engineering, it's technology, it's philosophy of, you know, kind of how to work with the market. And, you know, the timing is right. People are really interested in containers and Kubernetes. And so for us to be able to do that is really.
And I mean, it's an interesting time and probably the right time for some of these technologies to consolidate as well.
You know, and as a smaller company, it's hard to get to the reach that you want to, right? It's so, you know, we that's what we bring to them. We bring them, you know, huge reach. We've got a really good track record of, you know, companies that have really well-known brands that we don't screw up their brand. I mean, you know, Ansible is a great example of that, right? Like, Ansible had a humongous community with a very few number of people, and the Ansible brand and community still exists and is still, you know, well-known and loved. It's not just like, we don't call it Red Hat automation on purpose. And CoreOS is the same way. Like, people liked CoreOS. They know it, they know the brand. And, you know, so we have an interest in, you know, helping them grow to, you know, take advantage of what we do at scale.
I'm conscious you probably don't necessarily know the answer to the next question yet, but just in principle, OpenShift and CoreOS's products have a fair bit of overlap. So in principle, how will you look at how they sit together? And, you know, how will you look at what will stay, what will go, what will merge? How will you analyze this, move forward?
It's a fair question. It's a fair question. For a lot of reasons, right? If you're a customer, you want to know, you want to have some idea of like, okay, did I make a good investment? Or, you know, and so we don't have the full kind of integrated roadmap yet. We actually expect to have that by the end of the month. We're holding ourselves accountable to that. There's been pretty much nonstop engineering and product management meetings for the last 2 weeks of just, we had a very good sense at the time of the acquisition of like, okay, these are the core things that we want to do. Even the last 2 weeks of face-to-face meetings, you know, they start to unlock some things that you kind of can't share while you're doing an acquisition, right? Because the acquisition might fall through. And so there's only so much you can share. We've been really pleasantly surprised when we sat the engineers down and we went, okay, what does this do? What does this really do? Because sometimes you realize like, sometimes like what's in the product today and what's behind the scenes in the architecture could be, you know, kind of the tip of the iceberg. And so we've been really pleasantly surprised at how many more things are going to come out of it. Here's the high level way to take away from this is we want to maintain communities, right? Red Hat's always said, you know, we're about communities, good ideas come out of communities. So we very much want to maintain the communities that are there in place. You know, there will be, you can expect there will be some amount of you know, kind of synergy and cooperation that'll happen between the products that that appear to have overlap, right? It makes sense to say, let's take the best of what we have, you know, combine them where it makes sense, so that our customers get the best of that. And then, you know, right now our third super near-term goal is to say, look, you know, we have existing customers that had previous expectations, and they bought something based on expectation. We're not going to leave them on an island. So, you know, we will, like I said, we'll have a better integrated roadmap. And I unfortunately have been telling everybody, like, I don't want to give you a little piece of it because it'll create more questions than it answers questions. But, you know, our goal is very much to say, look, I mean, look, there's this thing that happens when an acquisition happens where people tend to want to say, like, oh, what are you going to kill off? And it's a fair question because they're, on paper, you might say, well, there's some things that overlap. Here's the reality is Red Hat, we don't own intellectual property, right? We're an open source company. We don't own intellectual property. We hire engineering talent, and then we go be part of communities, and then we know how to you know, take community assets and turn them into something that people feel are valuable enough to pay us subscriptions for, right? So it's not in our best interest to go into any acquisition to say, well, what do I want to kill off, right? It's in our best interest to say, what do we do to make this, you know, bigger than just the acquisition? And again, we feel like the biggest takeaway from this will be, it's going to help us accelerate the overall Kubernetes community to grow faster, which is everybody. And the really big thing is we look at what they've done with automated operations as so differentiating, and something that's really going to rejuvenate Red Hat. I mean, there's been so much excitement about what they do, that being able to bring our engineering, you know, kind of volume to their ideas is going to be really, really game changing. And it's going to be, you know, ultimately a big deal for customers because they're coming back to us and they're saying, man, I can't keep up with stuff. I can't keep up with doing development faster. And then you're telling me that operations has to do upgrades every 3 months for Kubernetes. And, you know, how do we stabilize these systems? Like something had to change in order for that kind of imbalance to work out. You know, development goes faster and operations stays stable. So, you know, what they do with automated operations is so big. And we're super excited about that too. So it gives you a little glimpse, and we talked about it in the FAQ, but gives you a little glimpse of kind of where we see this thing really being able to take off.
And it's actually interesting because Kubernetes is one of these projects that relatively quickly has become huge, really, with input from multiple large companies. I mean, it was a Google project, but I get the impression that Google don't really dominate the community too much. And you've also got Microsoft and Red Hat and a whole bunch of other large companies as well. So a lot of 100-pound gorillas in the room, really.
Well, yeah, I think you know, people always want to compare projects to other projects. I don't think the Google people. This is the interesting thing. So as incredibly smart as the Google team has been, and they're brilliant. I mean, really brilliant people, brilliant engineers, their willingness to be humble about this and not try and overtake the project. But also provide really, Google does this amazing thing where they look at problems like broad and deep, and their ability to give the community guidance on saying, you know, let's not make that short-term decision because here's the five things down the road that it's going to impact. And so Google has been amazing in number one, not trying to overwhelm the project, even though they were the big contributor, but also, you know, being this really good architect that says, hey, community-wise, these are the types of big decisions we should be thinking about. And because of that, you know, you've had the ability for Microsoft to come in and not feel like they can't do anything because, you know, they compete with Google, or Red Hat to come in and say, well, you know, we sell software both on-prem and off-prem, you know, not just into Google's cloud. Will they work with us? Like, so yeah, it's been the phenomenon of Kubernetes. The technology is really cool. The way the community has come together and allowed certain dynamics to just continue to be good, has been really, that's really the story, is that, you know, 3 years in, every company on the planet's working on it, and we don't see, you know, kind of some of the infighting or problems that have happened. And a lot of it, we give a ton of credit to just the Google stewardship of, you know, making it a great open source project, which is amazing, because they didn't have a known track record of it. And this is almost sort of like they knocked it out of the park on their very first try, which is really impressive.
I guess it's one of my my sort of two last questions for every interview. The first one is hard to answer, I think, because firstly, you've already answered it, and secondly, I don't think you have anything further to add. Is like, what's next for OpenShift then? After this, I guess, if mm-hmm. indeed you have anything else to plan after this, or is it a fairly big change anyway?
Well, I think so. We always, OpenShift is an interesting product, in that most IT products tend to be, they kind of fit a certain silo, right? Like if you make an automation product like Ansible, it tends to be something that like IT operations cares about, because they want to automate stuff. If you make a middleware product like JBoss, it tends to be relative to developers, because they go, oh, okay, this is, you know, services for my application. OpenShift is really interesting because it has relevance to both of those groups. And so if you think about our roadmap has to be, relevant to operators. So this is where a lot of the cool core OS stuff will eventually come in, right? You can just kind of envision automated operations, all that sort of stuff. But on the flip side, you know, we have to continue to innovate around what we do for developers. And what that ultimately means in the simplest sense is, I want to be able to run as many different types of applications containerized on OpenShift as possible. And that means, like, we've got to make it easier for you to take an existing application, put it in a container, run it on OpenShift. We see that happen a lot, sort of these lift and shift legacy stuff. We're seeing things like this Istio project, which is going to kind of reshape how new cloud native applications are built. We're seeing serverless frameworks that are being built on Kubernetes. So things like OpenFaz and Fission and Kubeless and OpenWhisk. We want to make sure that, we contribute to those projects upstream. We want to make sure that if somebody says, I want to build a serverless application, I want to use this framework, will it run on top of OpenShift? We just want to go, yes. Like, drop dead simple, yes. So we kind of have to, going forward, it's make it easier to operate, seamless, transitional, always secure. And then on the application side, we need to be able to support as many applications as possible, from big data to mobile to serverless to cloud native. And that's ultimately, you can map out that roadmap for several years ahead of just trying to continually get better at making it more flexible for developers and more stable for operators.